time to go out and...
Yeah, from that nightclub at the end of the world up here in Sebastopol, California. Mike Rupert, we are back on the Lifeboat Hour, Sunday, May 27th, 2012. You know, it's beautiful late spring, and what I've been doing is living more in my lifeboat than in the madness that Gary was talking about and that's going on out in the world. It's making a huge difference in my life. I spent a lot of time out in the garden this week, and, you know, what's in my garden? Are you ready for this? On this unbelievable 2.5 acres, we've worked hard. We have garlic, onions, calendula, broccoli, kale, radishes, beets, romaine, potatoes, onions, garlic, borage, beans, corn. We have zucchini, cucumber, pepper, pumpkin, squash. I mean, this list is like, and this is just an amazing place to live. Participating in this process of growing my own food and establishing a relationship with this land is just incredibly rewarding. Charles Eisenstein is back with us again tonight. He's in hot demand. I understand this is the second time he's been on PRN-FM today, and that's, of course, what this network is. That's why this network is doing so good. A couple quick comments before I introduce him. I was kind of taken by, aside from all the garbage and nonsense outside that's going on, the stuff that gets Gary and me mad, used to get me mad. John Edwards' jury trial is apparently going into like a sixth, seventh, eighth day of deliberation. I haven't seen a headline on him yet. But I got a feeling that John Edwards' case for his crimes of, you know, stealing money to cover up for a mistress and an illegitimate child while he's running for president, I got a feeling that might unleash a whole lot of pent-up, unspent energy against corrupt politicians. I'd be very interested to see what the verdict is in that. There's now 100 million Americans without jobs. 100 million. Imagine that. And U.S. citizens, we are now one step closer to becoming permanent tax slaves. They're trying to pass a bill to keep us from leaving the country if we owe taxes. I mean, that is all what it is. And a great many of us, we heard it with Peter Joseph last week, and Dmitry Orlov I've spoken to, have had something of epiphanies or major consciousness shifts within the last couple of months. Because from if you live in the world, the third dimensional world of Cartesian tyranny, of objective cold reason like a Vulcan, the planet is absolutely beyond human aid. It's not savable at that dimension, at that level of consciousness. It's not solvable with the systems that created this. And so, the options are clear. Paraphrasing Catholic Jesuit Anthony de Mello, when the situation gets this bad, you either commit suicide, go crazy, or become a mystic. There's no other choices. But consciousness expanding is definitely underway. I wanted to check in with someone who my medicine man said, this guy is the Minister of Finance for the new paradigm. I think we all agree with that. Charles Eisenstein is he's mid-40s. He's a graduate of Yale with a degree in math and philosophy. He lives in China and worked as a translator. Like me, he spent a great many years feeling as if he was doing the wrong things in the wrong places. I have to tell you, I don't feel that now. I feel like I'm in the right thing doing the in the right place doing the right thing. He's a seeker and a very, very spiritual aware guy. His writings in sacred economics about the false god that is money in this old dying paradigm are just some of the most brilliant, insightful stuff I've ever read. He became interested in money and finance with the financial crisis in 08, and he began publishing stellar articles on how money functions across multiple dimensions in our world. And I first became aware of him in early 2010 when I read this great article on the website Reality Sandwich called The Money and Crisis of Civilization. I quote him all the time. He's the author of Sacred Economics, a book you must get. Charles, welcome back to the show, man.
Hi, Mike. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Okay. Are you aware of any of these changes in consciousness I'm talking about? Have you had anything like that?
I'm seeing it all around me and hearing it from some of the most unlikely places. I was recently at a conference with Grace Dobbs. I'm not sure if you know who she is, but she's 97 years old. So she's seen it all, and she's been an activist for three quarters of a century. She was one of the elders of the civil rights movement, you know. And she said that essentially there's a transition happening today that's more profound than the transition from agriculture to the machine, or the transition from hunting and gathering to agriculture, and it's happening today. And I heard Pete Seeger say something recently too. And you know, Pete Seeger, I mean, he's
the father of Bob Dylan, man.
He's pretty hardcore. I mean, he's hard left. You know, he wasn't succumbing to Obama fever when he said that he's the most optimistic today than he's been in his entire lifetime. And I think that we can all feel it, even if we sense that things are probably going to get worse before they get better. We can feel that the ground is shifting.
Oh, absolutely. It was, I mean, I can't tell you the big grin, the big shit eater that broke out on Peter Joseph's face when I said they've had all the warnings they're going to get.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, you know, I felt for 3.5 decades that it was my, if you will, moral imperative, my spiritual imperative to warn.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just been so relieved of that, and it's been a very painful thing to endure, but I had to stay at my post as long as I felt that's what my duty was. But it's just so clear. What else is clear to me too, maybe you can expand on this, is that truly living from the heart and living from love is showing almost immediate response mm-hmm. in my daily life.
Yeah. That's like what you were saying in the introduction about the impossibility of solving our problems through Cartesian means.
Yeah.
You know, according to the understanding of cause and effect that we were brought up in, you're right. Like, any one of these problems, you know, desertification, or nuclear waste, I mean, any one of these is enough.
Fukushima, yeah.
It's enough to overwhelm civilization. But these... you know, Sun Ra, the entertainer from the 60s,
mm-hmm.
One of my favorite quotes was from him. He said, "We've tried everything possible and none of it's worked. Therefore, we must try the impossible." And
yes.
The impossible, you know, what we consider possible and impossible depends on our basic mythology about how the world works, which has been Cartesian, and is no longer.
No.
I was reading I was doing some research on permaculture and the yields possible per acre,
mm-hmm.
and I read this one guy who's I wish I wrote down his name, but he's a pretty big figure in permaculture, and he's, you know, goes way back. He worked with Buckminster Fuller, you know, he's and he had a 2-acre permaculture farm in California that fed something like 350 people.
Mm-hmm.
And had yields 8 times what the Department of Agriculture says is possible.
I'm on 2 acres, and I'm just in my second year of this, and I've had some help from some great teachers. Danny DeReuter had moved out here. She became our property manager. Then she went to the 2-week design course at Occidental Arts and Ecology, which is just amazing. Mm-hmm. That's Brock Dolman. And so I'm learning, but you know, I'm going to be harvesting 300 potatoes off of this 2 acres. That's not counting the grapefruits, lemons, oranges, limes, everything else that, and it's just by doing permaculture, which is, I love this, eloquently described as thoughtful prolonged and thoughtful observation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a control-based technology.
No.
You know, and when we talk about like Cartesian or Newtonian technology, it involves exercising a force. You know, that worldview says the universe works by force, and if you want to change something, you have to exert a force. Whereas permaculture and a lot of these other emergent technologies, they're not about a force. You know, they're about listening to nature, following nature's rhythms, kind of riding the wave of nature or co-creating with nature. But they're not about control, harnessing more forces.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in the social realm and the economic realm, the same kind of thinking needs to apply. You know, if you think that we're going to change the world by force, you know, overcoming the guardians of the status quo, the powers that were, as you've started calling them,
mm-hmm.
you know, if we think that we're going to overcome them by force, then it's hopeless because they've got more force. at their disposal than we do.
But what's also apparent to so many of us now is that the application of their force is not producing results that are even beneficial to them.
Yep, that's right. And that pattern is mirrored in every system that we have. You know, in medicine, for example, the technologies of force, or the technologies that are analogous to force, killing, cutting away, you know, vaccinating and antibiotics, and mm-hmm. and like, they sure seemed to be working really well 50 years ago. And you know, scientists were predicting the end of disease by the year 2000. And now we have all of these autoimmune diseases that against which these tools are impotent. And that breakdown is happening in every realm. You know, it's happening in the financial realm, too, where mm-hmm. the tools of the financial elites aren't working anymore. And I think it's happening in politics, too. And you were just mentioning about CNN, you know, and the propaganda
tools. Oh, all the
tools.
Mainstream numbers are just, they're just going down the toilet.
Yeah.
Which is one, that means nobody's paying attention to them anymore.
Right. Yep.
You know,
and PR doesn't even work very well anymore.
No.
Because we all discount anything that comes out of a politician's mouth, you know.
You know, I gave a speech in about a year ago in Nevada City called Post-Petroleum Human.
Mm-hmm.
And I articulated something there. I was like, we don't want to fight the old system. We just want to get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And CollapseNet is continuing to do what it does and did, because that's a level of consciousness that needs to be filled. That lamp still needs to be out there. That information still needs to be out there for people to wake up and help them, bring them to this level of consciousness. But truly, living and just consciously living in a place where you go, that paradigm has no power over me, is very liberating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so as we look at the economic stuff, and I'm sure you're just throwing your hands up like I am. It's like, who are they trying to kid?
Yeah, I don't think that even the masters of the propaganda believe their own propaganda anymore, which is pretty much a sign that the game is almost up.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's one thing that people don't understand, like the extent to which the people in charge do believe their own propaganda, and it would be nice sometimes to think that the reason that they're doing these things is that they're just evil. But you know, then like you actually talk to one of them, and they don't seem any more evil than anybody else. They just are trapped in a mythology that dictates their actions and dictates their very being.
That reminds me of a quote I read in Alexander Solzhenitsyn,
mm-hmm.
who wrote that men, in order to do evil, must first believe that what they are doing is good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's well said.
You know, and, well, he ought to know. He spent, what, 35 years in a gulag?
And, I think he only spent a few years in the gulag, actually.
Okay. But yeah. God, he was real, real poetic. I mean, he was a long read. I read the big long book by him, and that's where I read that line. But the afflictions and oppressions have produced many diamonds along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And we are there. We're coming up on time to play a song. You know, we are in a nightclub, so we have to have a song. And then we're going to come back, and we're going to ask you more about what you think is happening economically, and how much more, if any, you've refined your concepts about what a good, healthy economic structure might look like. But New White Trash is there's some good stuff. My life is free now. I'm no longer reading those stories every day, and I'm choosing to live the life, because if we are beyond human aid from that standpoint, I'm free. And it looks like Dougie Lewis, my bandmate, who's had some health problems, we're going to bring him out here to Sebastopol, and we're going to build a studio out back of the garage. We're going to start a new album, New White Trash's second album. And, you know, listen, if it is all going to come to an end, I know I want to be doing it lovingly and doing the things that I love best. So I feel like singing tonight.
Yeah.
I really do. Here's the song, On My Back Road. Thank you.
Sometimes love leaves a glance, passing by my fence, and I just look down at my hard-headed ground, and I hate to see you go, baby, hate to see you go. Yet you just slowed down, turned and looked around. Sometimes love looks back to see its track, and I hate to see you go, baby, hate to see you go. And when the time comes to mend your heart, I'll be there and I'll do my part, and you'll see that you ain't lost nothing at all. There ain't nothing like you on my back road, on my back road. Sometimes love takes a chance, there's a different dance. Does the fire still burn? Baby, make that turn and never look away, baby, never look away. Winter with me, leave your winter with me. Look into my eyes, look into my eyes, until the night yields unto the day, until the hurt begins to go away, till my loving brings your living back around. 'Cause there ain't nothing like you on my back road, on my back road. On my back road.
That was Back Road, written by me and Jim Sullins out in Nashville, my old bandmate and good friend. He played the piano on that. That's one of New White Trash's 37 originals, and that felt good. I really needed to sing something powerful tonight, or at least hear that. You can find New White Trash at www.newwhitetrash.com. The album is Double Wide, dot, dot, dot. You know the rest. We are on tonight with an amazing guy, Charles Eisenstein, who has some amazing perspectives on stuff. Now, when we had you on the show twice before, and you had talked about things like negative interest and other good, really terrific ideas about how we might shift the economic paradigm, has anything new come to you in the last few months?
I haven't actually been doing a whole lot of writing. I've been doing a lot of speaking and participating in various conferences and things. And I guess I'm just kind of gathering impressions. I haven't been doing a lot of theorizing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you've been observing.
Yeah, I've been observing and noticing the kinds of shifts that you're talking about. I had a thought while the music was on about collapse net and what you said about how, you know, you're still going to keep doing that, but in a way you've moved on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, you know, of... like, I actually read From the Wilderness way back when.
Mm-hmm.
I would read it sometimes, and it was kind of, nourishing for me in a way, even though it fed a lot of kind of fear and
mm-hmm.
anger.
Mm-hmm.
But that before I came across that and a lot of other material like it, that anger was kind of locked up inside,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't have... a way to get out, you know, and when people come to CollapseNet or some of the other kind of doom and gloom websites or conspiracy websites or whatever it is, you know, it kind of it validates that anger and it says, yeah, you weren't imagining things.
No.
And your sense of alarm, this kind of muted alarm that you've been walking around with and this anxiety, that's for a very good reason. Things are really bad. Your intuitions were right. You're not supposed to be satisfied with the life that's been handed to you as normal. And so it's really liberating and validating for people.
Yeah. You know, I was convinced that's the problem with being ahead of the curve. I had seen clearly while I was in Venezuela in 2006,
mm-hmm.
aside from the other stuff that happened, getting poisoned and all the stuff that went on. But when I came home to the States in October of 2006, right after Donnie Rumsfeld had quit over Pat Tillman,
mm-hmm.
I had the clear vision of the collapse as it is happening now in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Then, clear. And that's the price you pay for being ahead of the curve. And I've had to live, you know, for many years with a lot of that anger stuffed away.
Yeah.
And one of the recent real serious prayerful spiritual discussions I've been having with myself and with spirit is this whole question of ego and honor, wanting revenge, but coming fully to aware that having the power to enact, to carry out acts of vengeance is not something I want at all. All I'm after now is clarity and understanding.
Yeah, you know, at some point, like you want, you know, you're reading this stuff and you want those bad guys, the ignorant people or whoever's in charge, you know, you want them to get theirs.
Mm-hmm.
You want them to see how wrong they were.
Mm-hmm.
But then at some point, I think a lot of us are kind of going past that, and we're saying, you know, we'll take a transformation even if they never have their face rubbed in their wrongness.
Mm-hmm. You're right. I also think that I have this strong sense, and it's a deep subject, but I've been reading a lot of particle physics of stuff lately. Quantum
mm-hmm.
physics is just amazing stuff about the nature of reality.
Yeah.
And there's just a broad spectrum of great sources on it. But I think that the people who really want to and need to live in a fear-based three-dimensional world are going to get their choice and they're going to suffer their consequences. I'm not sure how the separation is going to take place, but I'm also equally convinced that a golden age is coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's a pass the popcorn deal for me. We'll just have to wait and see how that plays. We're coming up now on the bottom of the hour. After we do station break, if you'd like to ask a Charles a question or me a question, you can call in at 1-888-874-4888 here at PRN-FM on the Lifeboat Hour. Or you can email me directly. We already have one email from my really good friend, Windermere Assassin, a.k.a. Lead Death Care Nelson of Occupy London, and just a rocking dude. He sent us an email. We'll get to that after the break. But I want to take a second to talk to you about Collapse Network, which I am now completely out of and feeling very free. I am now living mm-hmm. in the place that I knew that I wanted to be living 5, 6, 7 years ago. But we stay at our post while the duty calls, and men and women of honor who do this. And I have to say that, Charles, about all of us who do this, we have such respectable and admirable honor toward the work that we do.
Yeah. Although, you know, I really want to, every time I start to think that I'm have more integrity or more honor than the people who don't get it,
mm-hmm.
I usually get a reality check
mm-hmm.
that brings me back to humility,
mm-hmm.
and I realize that, you know, in this new way of thinking and this new way of being that you could call interconnection or inner beingness or oneness or love, everybody is kind of pioneering a different aspect of it or a different
mm-hmm.
piece of the territory.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that I have something to learn from almost everybody I meet.
Yes, and maybe a word to go with honor there, because I think honor does hold a very important place. But I have yet to find out what that is. But there's another word that I find both in spiritual writing and in quantum physics, and that's coherence. We
uh-huh.
Those of us who do this work tend to vibrate and remain consistent and strong listeners to the vibration. I have seen such dedication throughout the course of my life on the part of everybody who has been doing this. it's just amazing to watch, and that speaks for you. Okay, we're coming up on a break here. At Collapse Network, the guys are doing great. They're covering stuff from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which has been scoring some victories on mm-hmm. the Jim Kunstler's blogging again. We've got Jim's piece out there. You're also going to see Brandon Smith from Alt Market. That's a great outfit. Chris Martinson and Guy McPherson with Nature Bats Last. He's an inspiring guy. And he's been on this show, and he'll probably be back. And Collapse Net also has a new one. I am not familiar with this guy. I'm looking forward to seeing him. Robert Denner, welcome, who is going to be doing economic commentary at Collapse Network, which is hanging in there, doing strong, and it's evolving like everything else is. So we are coming up on the break at the bottom of the hour. When you come back, emails to lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. 1-888-874-4888 with Charles Eisenstein on the Lifeboat Hour here on PRN-FM.
This way, please pull down your veil. I found one line in your heart on your hand by the nightingale. Socrates imagined what Aristotle blurred and Plato never. This way, please pull down your veil. I found one line to hold on your hand for the nightingale. Socrates imagined what Aristotle blurred and Plato never said. He really knew for sure if air was really A. Hold out your hand.
What a nightingale. That's Dougie Lewis from New White Trash. That was a song he wrote, which was inspired by Plato's Allegory of the Cave, which I'm sure that our guest Charles Eisenstein is familiar with. We are back on the Lifeboat Hour, and Charles, I love this. Synchronicity is happening like at amazing frequencies now. You know, you look at the clock, it's 11:11, or you think something mm-hmm. and it happens immediately. That's all right. So we have, get this, two callers on. Both of them are named John, and both of them are from Connecticut. I mean, I love when stuff like this happens. So the board operator in New York is just going to pick one, but I know I got it right if I say, hello, John from Connecticut.
Hey there. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay. Mr. Rupert, I remember you were saying at one of your speeches that the United States is probably going to break up into the various different regions as the collapse happens. And I recall another Russian political scientist saying the same thing. Anyhow, here's what I would like both of your opinions on. What do you see happening in the areas of the United States where the religious right is, as when they break up into their own territories, as far as their society, their laws, how they deal with collapse? Is it going to look different from a more liberal, open-minded state, or what?
Charles, take it.
Well, first, I do think that we're going to see profound political changes, and you know, one of the trends that we know is coming is a trend toward economic localization, which doesn't mean the end of all global trade, but it means a significant return to local economy and bioregional economy. And I think that political power will also devolve more onto a local and bioregional level. And as far as the religious right and stuff, you know, religionalism can actually be compatible with a lot of different kinds of political philosophies. You know, 100 years ago, during the 120 years ago, 1890s, you know, the religious fundamentalists were populists and challenged the economic elite. And I think that we're already seeing some kind of signs of that underneath the surface, and I think, but I just think that it's really hard to predict. Certainly, there probably will be episodes of fascism here and there, but I don't think that they're going to last very long because we've kind of already been there and done that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think we're almost more fascist now than we've ever been, you know, in this country. And so even though we might have kind of little, you know, totalitarian or fascist enclaves, or perhaps even on a larger scale, this shift of consciousness that's happening is affecting everybody.
Yep.
And I don't think that dark age will really last very long.
I would approach it from a slightly different perspective. What is happening to all of the mainstream news outlets is also happening to all religions in the same way. People are paying less and less attention to them. They're having less and less power. Their income is falling. And it's, I think it's, as I said in the documentary Collapse, God is on the table and every religion is going to be turned on its head probably this year. And we can see them all deteriorating. As I have always said since I wrote Crossing the Rubicon back in 04, but after 03, published in 04, geography trumps everything. Geography becomes the most important factor, and I see it happening on the macro scale as China is moving to close bilateral banking deals, as Japan is, with China. Japan is inexorably going to be drawn into China's orbit simply because of geography and the energy that's involved in maintaining that. Well, the same thing applies to the micro. And you will see energy made it possible to create all and enforce all kinds of divisions between people, whether on age, basis of age, sex, religion, whatever. And that energy is going away. And I think that geography and who lives close to you is going to become, as a matter of this consciousness shift, everybody's just going to be aware. You got to be nice to the people you live with. So, hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I think that's quite perceptive. Yeah. I was, the Catholic Church is having this huge financial scandal. And another news item was apparently they found out that despite all of these campaigns, these chastity campaigns, and they found out that something like 80% of evangelical Christians have sex before marriage. Like, not just 80% of the population, but 80% of evangelical Christians. You know, people are still, people don't really believe anymore.
Yeah, we want to get to the other caller, John from Connecticut, who's been holding on. The other John from Connecticut, are you still there?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, man. Two Johns from Connecticut. Hi. How cool is that?
It's a strange coincidence. It does explain why the guy on the line was asking which part of Connecticut. Well, anyhow, I wanted to talk about something personal to me. Just I'm trying to manage collapse in my own way. I love, and I just would appreciate some feedback or some advice if you could offer some. I know you're on the other end of the coast, but so I love my family. I care about them, but most of them are not awake to this phenomenon that's taking place. They're kind of zombie-like. Regardless of what I try to do to inform them. And over the past year, they've been doing this migration south for valid reasons, but I'm worried about the Gulf poisoning of the seafood. And just with collapse in mind, I just didn't think it would be a good idea to join them.
Then
I elected to just say, you know what, I love you. I care very much about our family, but I do not want to move with you. I'm going to stay.
You know, I'd like to say that, like poison seafood, you know, but like there's really no escaping the toxicity that's around us. It's really a matter of luck. You know, you can stay in Connecticut, and you don't know what's going to happen to a nuclear power plant there. You don't know where the toxic waste is buried. You know, we just don't know. And as far as your family, you know, I find that what wakes people up usually is when life stops working. And it hasn't happened for the majority yet, but it's coming because the systems are not working anymore, and sooner or later that invades people's personal lives as a health crisis, or they get fired, you know, laid off. And I think until that happens, people don't wake up despite all of our efforts to proselytize, to wake them up. That's not how change happens. Change happens through a collapse and a period of not knowing, you know, a period of wandering and searching, and then when that's over, then people are ready to think in a new way and to exist in a new way.
This is something that I would approach different, that I am approaching differently now than I would have 3 months ago. First of all, congratulations, you did the right thing. We all need to learn how to listen to our hearts and to our guts. Because listening to our heads is how we got here, in this system. And if your heart and your gut said don't go, I honor your decision for making the right call. But around zombie family members now, I think my approach would be to act and live joyfully from love and from the heart, and not try to sell them what I have, but to let people ask for it. One of the hallmark the pillars of strength of all 12-step programs is that they are programs of attraction rather than promotion. I want what you have. I see that you have something. What is it? In this short amount of time left, but trust me, now on the one hand, I know that I have reached through the course of my work over my life millions of people. And we see the positive results of that. But in this fundamental change that's happened now, now we just start taking care of ourselves and living and coming from the place of love and from the heart. And that's a powerful weapon. And I wouldn't have said that 3 months ago. But send them with love and, you know, pray for them. But by all means, just live your life and let them see you living it joyously and free and outside of the three-dimensional world based on fear that they live in.
That's the plan.
Okay, man.
Gonna
good luck.
Settle down and make my life boat here in Connecticut.
All right, man. And, you know, embrace the people who live close to you, build that tribe, and stay with your family up there. We have another caller, Chet from Minnesota. Are you there?
Good evening, Mike. I'm Chet from Minnesota, and I'm a friend of Bill W. And I love the way you've been talking about spirituality in the last several programs. It really hits home for me because I was hopeless, just like you, sir, and I found God through AA. And I just wanted to tell you that I've been following you since early days from the wilderness. I took a lot of time and I read your, studied your book, Crossing the Rubicon. Brilliant work, and it's going to go down in history as an epic work, sir. And I just want to encourage you to keep on doing what you're doing because you're really doing God's work. And there's far and few between. There's a lot of people out there professing to do God's work, but very few of them do. You're the real McCoy, so I really admire you, and I love listening to your program. And
thank you, brother.
I'm ready. I'm ready for the change, and you're making enlightening a lot of people. And I can't wait for your new book. I just wanted to say that this evening, and thanks for allowing me to share.
That's for thank you for sharing. And now this is an interesting situation. This reminds me. Sorry, Charles, I got a dish. This was laid in front of me. I think it was May the 12th, 1970, was the massacre at Kent State.
Mm-hmm.
I was a sophomore at UCLA, and I hated the Vietnam War, and I saw the riots and the protests as a result, and the UCLA campus was in flames. I mean, it was just a war zone. And I remember living this dual life that I had to leave my last class at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon on that day. And I had to drive because I was an LAPD intern to Rampart Division. And I returned and I was at the command post. And something similar like that has happened with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was active in AA for 21 years, 1 month, and 13 days. I know the big book inside out, backwards and forwards. As a matter of fact, a lot of the big book is going into my new book. But I have, in 2004, even as I was finishing writing Rubicon, I returned to normal drinking and using without cravings. So I am going to be again in that position where I have to challenge a coveted wisdom to tell the truth. But there is a line in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that has stayed with me forever. And the reason why that's so important is alcoholics, when they first got sober, it was the universal opinion that they were beyond any human aid a group of people. And the only answer was a spiritual answer, but there's a line in the big book. It said, our purpose was to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to our fellow man. And that has been the core of my heart for all the years. So
that's the top of page 77. That's what life is really about, having a true purpose, and you embrace that purpose with every fiber in your being, sir, and that's why I and many others admire you immensely.
Well, you know, there's an old saying in AA that I heard from an old timer a long time ago, too. It said, if you don't take the credit, you can't take the blame.
That's very true.
Charles, I'm sorry. I was rambling there. You're a guest on my show. You got any more on this thread?
No.
Well, I was thinking about the title of your show, The Lifeboat Hour.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you invoked the concept of a lifeboat several times. And I thought, you know, it can actually mean two things. And maybe you're kind of transitioning from the first to the second. Whereas the first concept of the lifeboat is, well, you know, the ship's going down and we're going to get onto a little safe boat, and so we're going to be safe while everybody else drowns.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much an old paradigm, which basically says that the fate of somebody else, the well-being of somebody else, doesn't really affect me because we're separate. And that is the paradigm of you know, dumping wastes onto the other, onto nature, exploiting other people for our benefit and the whole thing, right? But then another way to think of a lifeboat is
it ain't a death boat. I'm sorry.
Yeah, like is that, you know, we're gonna rescue people from the wreckage, and so metaphorically, then we're saying, you know, we're offering a new way to live, you know, a new way to think, a new way to be, a new way to relate, new technologies for living on Earth, just, you know, like permaculture that we just mentioned. And here is life. And so when this wreckage happens, and really not before, no one's going to want to get in the lifeboat while the ship is still floating. But as the ship falls apart and there's people swimming in the water and they don't know how to make sense of this all, and they're afraid, you know, and bewildered, and then we can say, oh, here's how to do it. Here's how to run a local currency. You know, here's how to grow food for 300 people on 2 acres. You know, and all of these other technologies and ways of being. And here's, you know, nonviolent communication. You know, and here's all of these different things. So it's kind of like a lifeboat onto which we welcome other people. And I think that ultimately that's the best survival strategy, is to have something to give.
I want what you have, yes. And here's how you get it. In other words, if you want to get really gigantic biceps, you don't ask a guy with skinny arms how to get big biceps, right?
Right.
But the one thing that's so clear and so consistent about all 12-step, and I should say that the 12-step are the same as the exercises of St. Ignatius in the Catholic Church. You find them in Buddhist Eightfold Path to Enlightenment. You know, the 12 steps are a how-to manual to actually plug into spiritual energy. Mm-hmm. But what they are very clear on is that the very, very first thing that must happen is not even the first step. You must have to be beaten into a state of reasonableness. You have to be hopeless. You have to have your consciousness open to the point where you're willing to try anything. In fact, willing to go to any length once you have been convinced that your head is not the answer.
Yeah.
And that there is a power outside of your head that is not you. That's the only thing you have to concede from a 12-step standpoint. There's no religion involved. But that complete deflation part is coming, and that goes back to the earlier question about how long to hold the door open. You know, we try to hold the door open as long as possible, but I think speaking for the people I've been talking to, man, we no longer feel any responsibility, which brings me, we're down to the last 10 minutes, to an email from Lee Deathcare Nelson over in London. How you doing, man? He writes, "Hi guys, loving the show tonight, really feeling the positive energy flowing from you both. I am too. I understand what you mean about just letting it go and focusing on what matters, but I can't seem to get there just yet. I feel compelled to keep coming back to try to reach out to a few more people. Is this part of the evolving process? Keeping one foot in both paradigms, trying to reach a few more? Your thoughts, please, guys." Charles?
I think there are times when reaching out to people is useful. You know, it's when they're swimming in the water next to the lifeboat. It's when the world has fallen apart and they're ready to hear something different. Then it's then that's the time, you know. And I think, you know, I find that I'm one of those people swimming outside the lifeboat too. Mm-hmm. And that I can only stay in the state of whatever you want to call it, spiritual awakening, a state of love, state of living from the knowledge that we're all connected. I can only stay in that state with the help of other people.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm alone, and especially because we still live among institutions that are of the old consciousness, and those institutions pull us back, you know, and I'm sure like you've had these experiences before where you have some kind of uplifting experience, some enlightening experience, you read some book, you know, and yeah, you know, And then you go back to the old world and the media and your job, you know, whatever else it is, all the voices around you and they pull you back, and the money system especially, you know, pulls us back. And so how do we stay in the new consciousness? We only can stay there with the help of everybody else who's there. And we're really all in it together. It's not a lifeboat that you can navigate. You're on your own, which is to be expected.
It's also a key to 12-step.
Yeah, and what you said about, you know, that we realize that our purpose is service to our fellow man, that is probably the most practical thing that we can do right now to survive this transition. It's to be of service.
And that's the only thing that works, but it also puts you, and I guess if I were to distill 21 years of 12-step work, again, with the study of all the other religions that I was led to, with that service comes at a, you know, for the alcoholic, it comes from a selfish standpoint. You must be of service to others or else you will drink again. You must pass it on. You must give it away in order to keep it. That is operating from a place of love. But the wisdom in all the spiritual and mystical paths that I have studied over three decades now is that gratitude is immensely more powerful than fear, and that you have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Not all the time. We get out in the world of the noise and we can get sucked back into it. You're right. But we can build those muscles to choose to live in a place of love rather than a fear. And I am more convinced on a daily basis that that has direct material impact on the world we live in.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. I think we really have turned the corner where we're going to abide in the love state, and instead of abiding in the fear state and visiting love occasionally.
And I also came to that empirically from my old left brain standpoint as I was looking at Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's now a bulge in the south wall, and that, you know, those fuel rods are just teetering, and they're just covered by plastic. It's an open, you know, and if it falls over, all those fuel rods get open air exposure.
Yeah.
And I've been watching that, you know, and I watched the technical stuff. it's clear that the Japanese are incapable of dealing with Fukushima. And that's when I said, you can't look at Fukushima as a Japanese problem. You must look at it as a human problem, which comes back to this thing called empathy, an empathic response, awareness of connection to other life.
Yes. Amen.
That's what we live for, you know. We're down to the last few minutes. I understand you have been speaking like a maniac. What's your tour like, and how do people find out where they can hear you speak, Charles?
Well, my website, charlesakenstein.net, is now fairly up to date, because I'm getting a lot of help now managing things.
Right.
I'm going to be in Europe a lot this summer.
Take notes. Come back and tell us what you see.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. It seems to be, you know, that's where the contagion has landed now. And since we're all interlinked, it's, you know, what happens to Europe is happening to us.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we're running out of time.
You've got about 2 minutes.
You know, the addiction metaphor is really potent.
It is, isn't it?
And illuminating for the financial crisis, too, where, you know, we're addicted to debt and using even more debt to solve the problems created by debt, just like an alcoholic does, and exhausting more and more of life in order to feed this money pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, when do we hit bottom? How do you raise bottom?
Well,
do you raise bottom for an alcoholic? Why is one alcoholic, the bottom is the deathbed, and another is not so deep? And I think it's the amount of love that person received in their life.
It's possible to quantify it on that level. But, you know, if the one-sentence version of my life's work from 1977 until today, I got sober in 83 and I left active participation in 2004, but I've been making a 12-step call on the human race my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way to know who and how is going to get it. What an intervention is raising the bottom. And the bottom has been raised for many millions of individuals, not just as a result of my work, but let's go back to King Hubbard and Colin Campbell and everybody, you know, and give all the credit where it is due. And that may collectively go, looking at it from the 100th monkey standpoint, to making it possible and even likely that we do reach the 100th monkey in time. But there's no way to know. But the way I looked at 12-step calls was, the reason I went to help other alcoholics who needed to get sober or sponsored men who'd been sober for a long time was so that I wouldn't slip back.
Yeah.
And that was the benefit for that.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, the addiction model gets stronger. There's a line in AA that says one drink is too many and 10,000 is not enough. And when I used to speak, I used to say the first drunk was worth $1 million in terms of, you know, how good it felt.
Yeah.
But at the end, it was worth 17 cents, and I was still going back to drink, trying to get that $1 million high again.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no meat on the bone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clearly where the old paradigm is at the moment, and all we do is try to remain available with love. Charles Eisenstein, I'm so sorry we're out of time, man. This has been an awesome show. You are coming back, or I will send my dog Rags down to hunt you down.
All right, let's do it again.
Oh, man. God bless you. Godspeed on your work. Go out there and spread the light.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay. For everybody else on the Lifeboat Hour, you can hear it in my voice, and I can see it happening, and we are part of something very, very exciting. And so what I would suggest you do tonight when you go home before you go to bed, instead of thinking of what you're afraid of, make a list of everything you're grateful for. Just make a gratitude list. Read it. See how it makes you feel. This is Mike Rupert on the Lifeboat Hour. We will be back in 1 week with more stories of a shift in consciousness. I'll see you.